We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are coming to understand more of the horrors, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are indelibly bourgeois and refuse to be so are increasingly aware. We who are unleashing powers, move toward life. We who experience tragedy in the unending cycles of destruction. We who gamble with our lives. We who are the spirits of the revolution. We will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution. We will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who believe in the flowering of freedom. We will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are thirsty for greater knowledge. We who walk the night this side of desperation. We who are thirsty and looking for better ways to proceed. We who tremble then proceed. We who are the spirits of the revolution. We will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution. We will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are wise enough to continue learning, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who find brothers and sisters in the struggling peoples of this earth, we who are coming to understand more of the mysteries, we who are coming to see more of the reality, we who have met the beast within ourselves, we who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are able to go beyond our anger, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are able to go beyond our awe, we who are not content to admit despair, we who care, we who burn, we who struggle with the knowledge that the path is long. We who are the spirit of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We whose radiance is a wonder in life, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We whose anger cannot be conquered, we whose love cannot be bound, we who are singers of the new morning, we whose tears have freely flowed, we who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who have come to understand something of the horrors, we will not fit in, we will not give in. We who are indelibly bourgeois and refuse to be so are increasingly aware. We who are unleashing powers within ourselves move toward life. We who experience tragedy in the as yet ending cycles of destruction, we who gamble with our lives. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We who are the spirits of the revolution, we will not fit in, and we will not give in. We will not fit in, and we will not give in.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. John Hopkins surgeon Marty Markery provides an insider's look at the dangers of staying in the hospital. He argues that patients are endangered by errors, overtreatment, and closed-door culture that protects medical practitioners first.
I mean, people are getting crushed right now with deductibles. They're essentially paying for all of their health care with the exception of catastrophic care. I mean, it's becoming a two-tiered system. We're seeing primary care doctors now say, you just pay us a couple $1,000s a year, we're going to take care of you with house calls. You have my cell phone. You call me at night. It's medicine the way they like to practice it, the way we've all dreamed of practicing medicine. It's healthcare the patients always dreamed of getting it. And they're rejecting, they're revolting against this bureaucratic regulatory system that involves fighting with insurance companies and all the hassles that doctors are getting crushed with right now.
So let's talk a little bit about leadership and the role that leadership plays. And I loved the story that you tell about Bill Brody. I use that story myself. But talk a little bit about that and the role and the example, if you will, of that story and what you think it means to senior leaders in healthcare.
You know, I find that many times everybody wants the same thing, but there's just sort of a breakdown of communication. And when Bill Brody walked through the ICU and started talking to nurses
about... Tell our viewers who Bill Brody is.
So Bill Brody at the time was the president of Johns Hopkins University, and he was a part of this initiative to have all the executives adopt a unit. And many of the executives at Hopkins adopted a unit, an ICU or a ward or a clinic or an operating room area, and they would meet with the staff, and we still do, and they would say, what are the safety concerns here? How are you going to harm the next patient? Anticipate what's going to go wrong next time we have a medical catastrophe. And let's face it, they happen every year at every hospital in the country. Doesn't matter if it's the best or worst, has medical mishaps every year. And these discussions create sort of an anticipation. It allows people to redesign and re-engineer the hospital system to make it safer. And, you know, the employees, the staff, and the nurses, they feel valued. They feel that people listen to them. And when we've got 46% of doctors saying they're burned out, they don't feel valued, they're getting crushed with malpractice and insurance and premiums and costs, and they're having to fight with insurance companies, feeling valued goes a long way. And not feeling valued by your hospital or your leaders is a serious way to alienate the very people that are responsible for safety and creating a safe culture.
So for those of us who are leaders or CEOs of hospitals, et cetera, what role should accountability and transparency play in the way that we conduct our daily business? What's your perception on that, and where can we improve?
Well, it seems like it's the old guard of the establishment, or if you will, the corporation that resists a little transparency. But when you talk to the individuals, the people, the moms, the parents, those who take care of patients, the doctor, these are all people who are also hospital administrators. They want the best thing. They understand the value of it. They're smart people. They are pushing this. And we're seeing this transparency revolution, not driven by patients, ironically, but driven by the very doctors and administrators and organizations that see the waste in healthcare. It bothers the heck out of them, and they want to do something about it. And we're seeing the American College of Surgeons, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, we're seeing organizations, LeapFrog, National Quality, we're seeing all these organizations rally together to say, you know, we think it's the right thing to do to be transparent about what we do. We're proud of our results. We've got nothing to hide. And if we perform well, the public should see it. And if we don't, public should see it anyway, because we're honest and transparent. You know, I once ordered a CAT scan on a patient. It got done on the wrong patient. And when, as soon as I learned about this, I ran to the patient's bedside and I said, I'm sorry, you didn't get your CAT scan because there was a mistake. I'm going to make sure you get it done right away. We made a mistake. I'm sorry. And to the other patient, I said, we're sorry we got a CAT scan. It was intended for someone else. It was a mistake. I'm sorry. I'll share the results with you if you want to see them. The patients were not angry like I thought they would be. They looked at me with a sense of appreciation. Thank you for being honest with me, doctor. And I feel like patients a lot of times just want honesty. They want to be treated with dignity. They want it to be treated like they would in any other business. And I think that's what people are hungry for in healthcare. And that's what the organizations and the leaders in healthcare are saying we need to provide to patients. We did a research study recently that looked at the number of national databases that follow hospital performance and patient outcomes. In my own field of pancreas transplantation, there are databases that we report our outcomes to. There's a National Pancreas Islet Transplant registry. They follow all the outcomes at all the different hospitals that do this. But the public has no access to this information. In fact, in our research study, we found that there are over 200 national registries that track hospital outcomes. Only 3 make their data available to the public. Most are funded by taxpayer dollars in some form. I think we as a society are starting to ask the question, do we have a right to know about the quality of our hospitals? And I think we're seeing leaders in healthcare step up and say, yes, we do.
So you've raised some provocative and compelling issues here, and your book really has, I think, been truly illustrative to people in terms of some of the things that are going on, and it's made the New York Times bestseller list, etc. I'm interested to know the comments of your peers in this, both perhaps younger physicians, older physicians. You've used the term old guard a couple of times. You put this out there, you talk about this. Many people are recognizing it. Talk a little bit about what impact it's had and really how people are feeling and the feedback you've been getting.
Well, I've gotten thousands of letters, many of which are handwritten, tens of thousands of emails that say, you know, my mom died because of a medical mistake. We didn't feel that we really were a part of the process. We didn't feel we were given all of our options. We think there was a mistake, or we know there was a mistake. Thank you for sharing this story. And it's almost as if everybody has a story. You know, I've got personal accounts here of people I know and are close to that had suffered from medical mistakes. Everybody, it seems like, has a story. It's the number 3 cause of death in the United States, medical mistakes. It almost seems like we all know somebody. And I think there was this general appreciation for talking about this openly and honestly. The younger doctors in particular come from a different generation. You know, the medical students nowadays have very little tolerance for not telling the truth in any aspect of life. I mean, they just insist on transparency in all aspects of their living. And then there are what I refer to as the old guard, those that say, you know, I'm an expert in medical mistakes. We shouldn't be talking about this with the general public. Or there was one individual, his response to the book said there was a typo on the inside jacket of the cover. I mean, here we're trying to say 30% of healthcare is unnecessary, and the response is there's a typo.
There's a typo in the book.
We're trying to say medical mistakes are the number 3 cause of death. We've got to be aware and talk about it. The response is there's a typo. Of course, there's going to be different responses. Healthcare is a very emotional issue. I mean, look at the way the politicians have divided the country and polarized the subject into sound bites. Healthcare is complex. The reality is there are good ideas on both sides of the aisle. And I think we just need to talk about common sense solutions in healthcare. You know, all the different ideas we hear about from politicians are really centered on how to pay for healthcare differently, how to fund the broken system. We don't just have to talk now about how to finance a broken system. We've got to move on to how to fix the broken system. And I think that is a fundamental discussion which gets to the base of transparency, patient outcomes, patient choice, and patient empowerment. I've lived in D.C. for a while, and I know politicians are not going to fix healthcare permanently. We doctors aren't going to do it. Insurance companies are not going to do it. It's going to be the patients, and we've got to give them good information. If 60% of New Yorkers are looking up a new restaurant's track record and ratings before they go there, why do they have to walk in for their healthcare blind about what a hospital's C-section rate is, or their infection rate, or bounce back rate, or how many hip operations they do, or how many knee operations they do? If you have Lyme disease, do you want to go to a hospital that you're the only case in 5 years they've seen, or do you want to go to a hospital that treats 50 cases a year? These are basic things the public demands in any other industry, and I think we can provide these things in healthcare through more transparency.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So that leads me to the you use the term Fred Flintstone care in your book, and talk a little bit about that, and you think or your thoughts around how that plays into what you just described, which is, you know, we have 60% of New Yorkers who will go online and look at the restaurant review, but they'll just walk right down the street to their hospital without really doing any due diligence, et cetera. And how does the kind of Fred Flintstone care and the culture, if you will, of medicine play into that?
You know, I am constantly flabbergasted at how patients will walk into a doctor's office and the doctor just will not mention the superior option to the patient. I think sometimes because they're worried about losing the patient to another doctor. You know, we get paid a lot of money based on the quantity of what we do. That's got to change. We've got to be paid based on the quality and our outcomes. We've got to get away from this heavy volume-oriented way that we finance our healthcare system. We're just incentivizing people to overtreat. And when we ask doctors in a survey, why is this overtreatment epidemic so broad? They say, because we're so heavily incentivized. Usually they don't say themselves. The other doctors are heavily incentivized. And there's malpractice concerns and other things that they have the answers. A lot of the doctors out there have the answers on how to address this problem of medical mistakes and overtreatment. Look, I talk to doctors almost every week that say, you know, I'm getting text messages and emails from my superiors to do more operations. And I feel like I'm doing the right thing for my patients. I'm doing all I can. They don't like that. That's not the type of medicine. That's not the profession they went into. And I think we need to start thinking about how patients can get the best options by eliminating these heavy incentives to under-refer. There are patients that I met rotating as a resident that were not told that there's a superior way to reconstruct the breast after a breast removal because the local plastic surgeons don't do it that way. They do it another way that the research and the literature clearly show is inferior. Now, it's still a standard of care. They're not going to get sued for doing it. But there are these wide variations. In my own field of pancreas surgery, if you have a small pancreas cyst that needs to be removed in the tip of the tail of the pancreas, if a patient walks into one hospital or one doctor's office, they'll have a big midline incision, they'll have the tail of their pancreas removed and their spleen. They walk into another doctor's office, they'll have a small, minimally invasive keyhole incision and have the tail of the pancreas removed and not remove the spleen. I mean, we're talking about removing or not removing an organ based on which door you walk into. These are all good hospitals, good reputations, good doctors with good reputations, radically different ways of doing things. Removing a colon. Now, there's two totally different ways of doing it, minimally invasive and through an open incision. And some say there's you could do it either way. We have a New England Journal of Medicine study that's over 10 years old that shows the minimally invasive is better. And it's common sense it's better. But yet the Wild West of medicine would have it that only half the patients that are great candidates for the minimally invasive will ever have it done that way.
You know, you use the term the Wild West of medicine, and elsewhere in your book, you talk about the need to have a new sheriff in town. So talk to me a little bit about this concept of the new sheriff in town, or accountability, or holding people responsible, and how that balances with what we frequently hear when we try and move forward with standardization or accountability as to the art form of medicine. How do those two things kind of play out?
I get the art form of medicine. I mean, most of the patients that come to see me are complicated pancreas tumors. This is my own area of expertise. And just in my field, I see these complex cases where patients are told there's nothing that can be done at the other hospitals. And then they come to me and we say, yes, it's high risk. We'll take it on. These are the risks. If you want to go for it, we will go for it. And doctors were right for a long time, I think, to say, hey, wait a minute. We can't make our outcomes transparent. It doesn't appropriately adjust for the high risk nature of the cases we take on here. I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, doctors were right to lead the opposition to transparency because, you see, if we simply make the raw data transparent, we could punish doctors that take on the noble high-risk cases and reward those who discriminate against them. We'd actually create perverse incentives. But now the doctors are saying we've got valid ways to measure quality. We've created these measures. We've endorsed them. We monitor them with our own national registries housed by the doctors' groups. We think it's the right time to make this available to the public. And for the first time ever, this is an exciting time in healthcare and with transparency. We've got Consumer Reports now partnering with doctors' groups to make the national registry outcomes available in easy to understand ways so patients can look up with an app what the risk-adjusted performance is of a heart surgery center in their community. I mean, this is, I think, the future of healthcare. It's an exciting time. It's a revolution. I've sort of become a observer, if you will, or a reporter on this subject. I'm not the leader of the transparency revolution in healthcare. Matter of fact, we don't have one leader. This is a truth, something we believe in and we're as passionate about as the art of medicine itself.
So you talk about where perhaps a decade or more ago, doctors protected that information because it could be misinterpreted, if you will. And then there's been this evolution of thought toward transparency, partnerships between kind of consumer groups and physicians. If that's the case, what impact has that had in terms of our overall levels of quality, safety, efficiency, and mistakes? Is it because this movement's been going on for some time, yet you cite some really challenging cases and statistics that are going on. What's your sense of how things have moved and where is it going in the future?
That's a great point. You know, we've gotten burned with transparency. We've had systems that are local and small, and either the patients haven't known where to get the information. I mean, let's face it, unless there's a central site like hospitalsafetyscore.org run by LeapFrog or the Consumer Reports site, if there's no sort of master dashboard, then we're not really informing the public and we're not really guiding them. And the other thing is, a lot of times we've created so many loopholes that we doctors have learned how to game the system. And that's what happened in New York with the heart surgery program. There were many successes. We saw for the first time CEOs and doctors are focused on a common mission to reduce certain complications after surgery. The CEOs were saying, here, how about a dedicated anesthesiologist who specializes in heart anesthesiology? And the doctors said, you know, are saying, yes, that's what we need. There's this tremendous teamwork we saw with transparency, but the system wasn't perfect. And for the first time now, I think we're seeing the doctors' groups better define what is a complication. They are using independent nurses at a hospital to track the outcomes. You know, early versions, we would just ask the surgeon, what's your infection rate? Well, of course, we would understate our complication rates, and it was a uniform bias. It's just the nature of sort of assessing your own performance. And I think now there's an exciting opportunity. We've got organizations and doctors lined up to say, look at all these sites that we can populate with information. The Affordable Care Act tried to push some of this forward. I believe there's a lot more we need to push forward. It said readmissions now are going to be available to the public. And for the first time ever this year, people can look up a hospital's infection rates on the National Medicare Master site, hospitalcompare.hhs.gov. For the first time, they're going to be able to look up a hospital's bounce back or readmission rates, number of people that just come right back into the ER after they go home. These are what doctors generally consider to be valid metric, not perfect, valid ways to measure quality. And I think we're going to see consumers rally around them. We're going to have to fix them. They're not good. They're not perfect. We're going to have to make them better. We're going to have to refine them, revise them, and make them more risk-adjusted and valid. But it's a tremendous time right now in healthcare.
He said, son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say? If I said that you could just carry this gun, you'll even get paid. I said that sounds pretty good. Black leather boots, spit shine so bright. They cut off my hair, but it looks alright. We marched and we sang, we all became friends as we learned how to fight. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag trust. I kicked in the door, I yelled my commands. The children, they cried, but I got my man. We took him away, a bag over his face, from his family and his friends. They took off his clothes, they pissed in his hands. I told them to stop, but then I joined in. We beat him with guns and batons, not just once, but again and again. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. is a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. She walked through bullets and haze. I asked her to stop. I begged her to stay, but she pressed on. So I lifted my gun and I fired away. And the shells jumped through the smoke and into the sand that the blood now had soaked. She collapsed with a flag in her hand, a flag white as snow. A hero of war, is that what they see? Just medals and scars, so damn proud of me. And I brought home that flag, now it gathers dust, but it's a flag that I love. It's the only flag I trust. He said, son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could?
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.